Campus FM presents a lecture organized by the Faculty of Theology in collaboration with the Augustinian Institute entitled Augustine, Aristotelianism and Aquinas. This lecture was delivered by Professor John Rist from the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom.
Your Excellencies, Right Honourable Gentlemen, Ladies and Gentlemen, I'm very pleased to be here to give this 10th lecture in this series. The exact relationship, an exact and varying relationship between Augustine and Aquinas is very inadequately understood. This paper is an attempt to raise a few of the issues where an understanding could be advanced further with some ease, I think, and hopefully will encourage other people to be interested in this question. Exactly what does Aquinas make of Augustine? Does he improve on him? Does it make it worse, or is it a mixture of the two? As is fashionable these days, I'll start with a little story. I was once standing in line in a dining hall at the University of Toronto, next to the distinguished Aristotelian scholar, Father Joseph Owens. I was wondering whether to select a certain item on the counter, which appeared to be a rissole. And I said to Owens, "What do you think that is?" And he immediately replied that it was substance without essence. An Aristotelian impossibility, obviously. Owen's philosophical master, Étienne Jusson, made a much less frivolous mistake when he claimed, not least in a book called Being and Some Philosophers, that Platonists are regularly confused about the relationship between essence and existence. I charitably assume that his attention there was largely directed not to some ancient Platonists of the ancient world, but particularly to Avicenna, in the Middle Ages, who in distinguishing essence and existence was induced to argue that existence is an accident of essence. For ancient Neoplatonists, of course, the essence of a thing is associated with the degree of its unity as that thing, and that unity, indicating not that a thing is, but what a thing is determined by its return to its source. Augustine thinks in the Platonic tradition, and it may be helpful to see why Gilson's charge should not be brought against him, as indeed against most other ancient Platonists or Platonizers. For Gilson did indeed bring such a charge, at least by misassociation against Augustine, when he wrote, quote, "Faithful to the tradition of Plato, St. Augustine thinks less about existence than about being. And since he is convinced that to change is not truly to be, the contingency he tries to explain is not so much the contingency of existence, in the proper sense of the word, as the contingency of beings, which even though they are not nothing, still do not have a sufficient reason in themselves for being what they are." Close quote. Problems about existence will be one of the topics I want to look at in considering more precisely something of the relationship between Aquinas and Augustine, and not only in light of a comment of Alasdair MacIntyre's on another of my present themes, that of freedom and the possibility of virtue, that in Aquinas, quote, "the Augustinian understanding of fallen human nature is used to explain the limitations of Aristotle's arguments, just as the detail of Aristotle often corrects Augustine's generalizations," close quotes. But before proceeding to these specific cases, I want to put Aquinas' philosophical situation in the late 13th century into a broader cultural context. That should help us understand something of the wider importance of Augustine in Aquinas' philosophical history, and hence of its significance in the fortunes of philosophy itself. A few years ago, well before 9/11, the novelist Anthony Burgess wrote an article in the London Times in which he raised the question of the differing attitudes of Orthodox Judaism, Islam, and Catholic Christianity towards philosophy. His main point was that Christianity had succeeded in establishing a modus vivendi with philosophy, while Islam had failed to do so, and he pointed to the comparatively minimal development of philosophy in the Islamic world from the time of Al-Ghazali until Western transplants began to arrive in the 19th century. His thesis was that, rightly or wrongly, the dominant forces within Islam judged philosophical inquiry incompatible with right religion, and therefore secured that it be actively discouraged or emasculated, just as Western secularism and post-Christianity are judged incompatible with faith by most Muslims today. The picture I've drawn here is obviously oversimplified, but there's certainly something in it, and it raises the following question. If it was Aquinas, above all, who achieved a cohabitation between Catholic Christianity and philosophy, including what he might have thought of as bad philosophy, whereas Avicenna and Averroes failed to perform a parallel operation in Islam, and Maimonides on the Jewish side may be said to have both failed and succeeded, though I don't want to push that further today, and if the form of philosophical challenge which they all faced was the same new Aristotelianism, can we identify some of the reasons for Aquinas' comparative success? For if I'm right about him, and if Burgess were right about him, it was indeed a success which should be identified as one of his major contributions to Western and indeed human culture. It seems to me that the influence of Augustine in general and his relationship to Aquinas in particular provides an approach to significant parts of this question. Not, of course, that we should think only of Augustine. We should also allow Pseudo-Dionysius, Boethius, and many another predecessor, both direct and indirect, their due share of the credit. But insofar as everyone in the Catholic Middle Ages was in some sense an Augustinian, one has to recognize the special significance of the Bishop of Hippo. In what follows, therefore, I want to discuss three dissimilar instances of how Augustine relates to Aquinas, and then attempt a few quick conclusions. The themes I want to talk about in different degrees of detail are, one, what Aquinas would think of as the distinction between essence and existence and their identity in God, two, the relationship between Aquinas' semi-Aristotelian account of freedom and Augustine's theories about the fall of man and original sin, and three, some aspects of the Platonic Augustinian problem of the relationship between the soul and the body, especially in the case of females, in the context of a Thomistic account of man as created in the image of God. In each of these cases, we shall see Aquinas reacting to his Augustinian heritage, whether consciously or unconsciously, in different ways. But these different ways will help us to reach more general conclusions. I shall leave you to make your own decisions as to the degree of philosophical, as distinct from cultural, success Aquinas achieved in transforming and adapting what he received. Only wishing merely to draw to your attention the breadth and depth of the specifically Christian tradition of philosophy and theology, not merely of canon law or its equivalent, which Aquinas inherited, as well as some of its limitations and, in that historical phrase, some of its incomplete successes. 1. Existence. Here I can be comparatively brief on Aquinas, since I believe the basic facts are comparatively well established. But on Augustine and on the Platonic, Stoic, and Neoplatonic traditions upon which he drew, I shall have to linger a little longer. First, an important footnote about Aquinas, which will help us understand why his reconciliation of Aristotle and Augustinianism was somewhat easier than might seem likely, if in pure historical ignorance, we now were simply to read through Aristotle, Avicenna, and Augustine and compare them. Certainly, much Thomistic interpretation of Aristotle goes beyond Aristotle. By that, I do not mean that if Aristotle lived in the 13th century, he would necessarily have repudiated the thought of Aquinas. What I mean is that if he had been willing to accept the thought of Aquinas, he would have had to abandon some of the ideas he himself proposed in the 4th century BC, as well as allow that Aquinas had raised new, strictly metaphysical questions which he himself had not considered. An example of the latter, of course, would be that Aristotle's first cause is a first cause of motion. Aquinas' first cause is the cause of the existence of things. When I was a student, we were told that many of the differences between Aristotle and Aquinas were caused by the need for Aquinas to bend what he wanted to say so as to make sure his ideas did not come out as counter-Christian. Parallel suggestions were, of course, made about Maimonides and Averroes as well. Much of that is just wrong. We now know that an apparently more Thomistic Aristotle, that is, an Aristotle who, for example, is a defender of providence and offers a first principle who is an efficient cause of the universe, not just a final cause, is largely the product not of Abrahamic religion, but of the late antique Neoplatonic commentators on Aristotle, such as Simplicius, which brings him much closer to Augustine than his historical original would have wished. Such history, of course, was not known to Aquinas. What he did know, however, was that there were various versions of Aristotle in circulation, And he set himself to show that of these, of those available, none of which was always the historical Aristotle, some were not only better philosophically, but a fortiori for him, more Christian than others. In a sense, all this is a bit irrelevant. There's no reason why Aquinas, as a Christian Aristotelian, should feel any obligation to follow Aristotle slavishly, even had he had the historical knowledge to do so accurately. The more surprising thing about Aquinas and others in the 13th century is not that they diverged from the historical Aristotle, but that they followed him as much as they did. And indeed, over existence, Aquinas hardly follows the historical Aristotle at all. Like all philosophers, Aquinas' attention was drawn to what his predecessors and contemporaries read and what they found puzzling. And along with Aristotle, those read included Avicenna and Averroes, and Aquinas knew that they differed radically over existence, Averroes ridiculing Avicenna's claim that even in God, existence is an accident of essence. But what seems to have interested Aquinas even more than the dispute is the fact that the relation between essence and existence was debated at all. This was not, or at least appeared not to be, a debate with which his early Christian predecessors had been much concerned. But it clearly was an important debate once begun for a Christian philosopher. Aquinas' solution, as we know, is that in God, essence and existence are one, in that God's necessary existence itself is his essence, while the existence and essence of all else, all that is created, is possible. So the distinction between creature and creator can be expressed in terms of possible and necessary existence. This is not a problem in Aristotle precisely because, as I have noted, Aristotle has no concern to explain the existence of things as such. The Aristotelian world is a given. Its nature and its changes, not its existence, are what is to be explained. The reason for this difference between Aristotle and Aquinas is susceptible of a quite simple philosophical explanation. And as we shall see in a moment, the philosophy is borne out by the history of philosophical theology. Of course, since Aquinas takes Aristotle's first principle to be an efficient as well as a final cause, in a Neoplatonizing manner, that is, in refuting both Avicenna and Averroes, he may have supposed that he really was defending Aristotle. In fact, he was offering a new defense for what was, by his day, a traditional Christian position. As I have said, it was one of Gilson's most serious mistakes to claim that Platonists in antiquity, as well as later, were blind to questions of existence. In part, the mistake was due to his tendency to assimilate ancient Platonism to modern idealism. In any case, a brief survey of ancient thought and assumption about existence should set the matter out more clearly and bring us to Augustine himself. So far from being blind to existence, most ancient philosophers were puzzled about how one could think about anything else, fictitious subjects, let's say, like chimeras, let alone non-being or nothingness. The full name of each Platonic form is the existent ex itself. In the Timaeus, Plato, who had long boldly denied the axiom of Parmenides that what doesn't exist cannot be spoken of or thought, but who also recognized that if one wishes to explain what is, and both what is and what is not, one must speak of what is not, suggesting that a kind of bastard reasoning, in Greek anothos logismos, is required to handle non-being. His thinking is clear. If you can't see or otherwise indicate non-being, what is it that you are speaking about? It might seem, rightly of course, as though you were referring to something which is no obviously existing object of reference. Leave Plato aside and turn to Aristotle's categories. Here we have 10 or so ways of speaking about what there is. Aristotle found it very difficult to distinguish true from false statements about non-existent subjects. If something doesn't exist, how can anything true, i.e. referring to reality, be said about it? So what do you do with a proposition like Alice in Wonderland is blue? How do you distinguish that from Alice in Wonderland is white? It was not least to remove analogous difficulties, it seems, that the Stoics proposed that before discussing existence in the world in terms of their own category system, we should raise the prior question, does X exist or not? If not, it cannot be characterized unless we treat it as if it exists, and we should be sure that we are making the right judgment on that. Contrary to some current opinion, There is an existential sense of the ordinary word to be, anai, in ancient Greek. But in many Hellenistic quarters, another word gradually succeeded the more common anai, to be, and they were eventually followed, especially among philosophers, and to meet philosophical needs, a corresponding noun meaning existence. The noun is in Greek, is hyparxis. But it was probably a Jew, Philo, for reasons to which I've alluded, who first was concerned to identify whether things exist or not before categorizing what they are, and made the move of distinguishing God's existence, we know that he exists, from questions about his nature. We do not know what he is, that is, his ousia in Greek. Why then did Philo make this move? Because his God, the Jewish God, as distinct from the Greek gods, is somehow omnipotent. And because he wanted to distinguish God as some kind of creator from creatures. I say some kind of creator, because I do not think that Philo, any more than the earlier Christians, had yet distinguished between the creation of creatures ex nihilo and their total dependence on their creator. So we've established that by the Christian era, there was a full awareness among Platonizing philosophers about the importance of existence, and no question of it being understood merely as unity or self-identity. And among Jews and Christians, a growing awareness that the old distinction between the one and the many must be explicated as also a distinction between a creator and a creature. But a key problem remained both for Christians and for pagans. How do we name such a first principle? To cut a long story short, Plotinus's view, which was known to Augustine, was that the first principle was to be called the One, and that it is beyond being in some sense, that is, not a particular substance. It certainly exists, though it has no specific form, which is, of course, why it can't be directly described, and no specific limits, that is, it is somehow not indefinite, but infinite. Augustine's predecessor, Marius Victorinus, knew that the first principle, according to this tradition, is to be called the One, Unum, as well as Ipsum Unum. And as beyond being, it is called a pre-being in some way or another. He called it existentia, the Latin version of the phrase in English, existence itself. And he used the Latin word esse to be as a mere token, intelligible to the conoscenti for the Greek word for finite being, while significantly claiming that it's in virtue of the power, potentia, of existence that life and happiness are possible. Augustine, however, declined to call God the One and to use any form of the language of beyond or pre-being, though importantly retaining most of that language's conceptual content. He prefers to call the first principle simply God, and to refer to him as the highest or truest being, or as being itself. Of course, he agrees that it exists, and that in a sense Philo and his many Christian followers were right in saying that we can agree that God exists, but it's impossible to determine immediately what he is, unless, of course, God, through Christ, is able to show us something of his true nature. In other words, God exists as such, without further determination readily accessible to us. To be is simply his nature. So Augustine's position, which clarifies and advances the intent while often discarding the language of Neoplatonism, is that God exists as the unique creator ex nihilo. The existence of all else is dependent on his will. Since Augustine also followed an ancient Christian tradition, clear at least since the second century bishop Theophilus of Antioch, that to deny creatio ex nihilo, creation from nothing, understood as in or with time, would be to undercut the absolute supremacy of God, and indeed the intelligibility of the concept of God itself, pointing towards Manichaeism in fact, he is able to make the dependence of all else on the first principle clearer and more radical than was possible for the Neoplatonists, who wanted to combine total dependence of the many with the notion that since the One has always existed, the others must always have existed too. For Augustine, God is the creator ex nihilo of the universe, of which every part is dependent on its creator. But Augustine, sometimes sadly, knows very little about Aristotle, and some of what he thinks he knows he doesn't like. He makes no use of anything like the Thomistic language of an act of existing. He thinks rather, as did Victorinus, particularly, however, of God's power. Hence, if we want to find something in Augustine which does part of the work of the active existence language in Aquinas, that is where we have to look. God's nature as being itself is the power which creates all finite beings from nothing. Perhaps it might be objected to some Neoplatonists that they explain only how the one is some sort of form for what it produces, or for what participates in it, not how it imposes that form. But Augustine already knows that Plotinus will distinguish two centres of activity, that is, the activity of a subject as such, and the activity of its external effects, a theme which Aquinas also deploys in the Summa Prima Pars 48. So keeping in mind Augustine's position on the total dependence of all on the God whose existence and power of existence is, we might say, unmitigated, let us turn back to Aquinas confronting Avicenna and Averroes on necessary and possible existence. And let us say that the core of the emphasis on existence is that only a creator could be a necessary being. In Augustine's language, that is, has the power to be what he is. All others, though they might exist as possible thoughts, are also only possible existence. At the centre of Aquinas' position on necessary being, then, is the Augustinian and generally Christian doctrine that all of creation depends on God. Where, of course, Aquinas goes further is to combine the essence-existence distinction in Avicenna's version with his inherited Christian data to produce a specific argument for the existence of God. Perhaps indeed the argument of his set, which has the greatest rational force. But let us return again briefly to Ex Nihilo. Augustine inherits a view that without it, the concept of God itself is unintelligible. Aquinas, on the other hand, thinks that although God is somehow a creator ex nihilo, that doesn't entail that he must also have created the universe in or with time. That the world has not always existed, he thinks, is given by faith. It cannot be demonstrated, though the philosophical probabilities are in favour of it, Summa Contra Gentis 238. In this, he's arguably closer to the position of Plotinus than to that of Augustine, and it's interesting that the more obviously Augustinian Bonaventure holds a different position. But I'll now move to rather simpler things. In my remarks so far, I showed Aquinas taking advantage of a new philosophical tradition, that is, Aristotelianism, to express a philosophically technical version of ideas which had been expressed more crudely, but perhaps theologically more challengingly, by Augustine and other patristic writers. In dealing with essence and existence, we find Aquinas dealing sympathetically with Aristotelian metaphysical traditions about substances as he understood them, mediated through the contrary views of Avicenna and Averroes. And on at least one issue, the matter of the eternity of the world, at least seeming to give the Aristotelian picture more credit than Augustine would have allowed. When dealing with the human capacity for moral action and the effects of the fall, however, we see an area where Aquinas, to the apparent dismay of some of his more modern admirers, normally follows Augustine much more directly. Though I suppose these modern admirers would also want to say that happily, from their point of view, Aquinas sounds at least at times a bit more Pelagian. In the index to Robert Pasnell's recent exactly 500-page book on Aquinas, Account of Man, there are just two references to grace in the body of the text, and the word fall is not indexed. And in those two references we find an apparent contradiction, or at least an attempt to find some wriggle room in which to slip a slightly less Augustinian and perhaps more Pelagian interpretation in. In the first passage, where he's discussing the Summa Prima Secunda 78 on the temptations of the passions, we read that Aquinas seems more Augustinian than Aristotelian. There follows a reference, however, to Augustine's divided will in the Confessions 8.5. But according to Pasnow, quote, Aquinas resists the Augustinian suggestion that he never could have overcome his weakness on his own. Augustine, in giving all the credit to God, implies that we are helpless in the face of our weakness. This is quite alien to Aquinas' approach, close quotes. Pasnow then cites a passage from the Disputed Questions on Evil, which doesn't seem to justify the account of freedom which he claims is Aquinas' view. In any case, a few pages later, he says, quote, by bringing grace into the picture at this point, Aquinas moves in the direction of a more Augustinian account, on which our tendency to act against reason is a part of the human condition that only God can reliably cure, close quotes. And continues Passnow, quote, Aquinas' broader thinking about grace confirms this perspective. Without grace, human beings inevitably stray from the good. Grace provides us with the infused virtues, etc. Passnow's is a book full of references. But along with only two references to grace and none to the fall, there's also none to a well-known contemporary philosopher, Alistair MacIntyre, who takes a much less grudging and much more helpful view of Aquinas' handling of the role of grace. So far from regretting its appearance as an apparently improper encroachment on human freedom, MacIntyre rightly observes that it's precisely because of his insistence on grace that Aquinas' ethics breaks with the ethics of Aristotle on several important questions. Quote from MacIntyre, I also argued earlier that Aquinas does not merely supplement Aristotle, but that he shows Aristotle's account of the teleology of human life is radically defective. Close quotes. But though MacIntyre is right in insisting that Aquinas' introduction of a broadly Augustinian account of grace, Pascal's rather different presentation sheds light on what is certainly a problem for Aquinas, and in a rather different way, a problem for Augustine as well. Let us approach this difficulty by something of what Aquinas says about the notorious problem of the natural and more than natural ends in the Summa Prima Secundae 62. Quote, our happiness or felicity is twofold. One is proportionate to human nature, and this we can reach through our own resources. The other, a happiness surpassing our nature, we can obtain only by the power of God. To be sent to this supernatural happiness, we have to be divinely endowed with some additional sources of activity. Their role is like that of our native capabilities, which direct us, not of course without God's help, to our connatural end. Such sources of action are called theological virtues. Close quotes. There's an oddity about this passage, which may be illuminated by a text from the De Veritate, in which Aquinas observes that man can choose to do non-moral things without grace, but that without God, since the secondary cause is ineffective without God as primary cause. Similarly, our present text seems to suggest at the beginning that we can reach our natural end through our own resources. But later, a caveat appears, quote, not, of course, without God's help, misquotes. This idea is glossed elsewhere as follows, quote, in the state of corrupt nature, people fall short of what they could do by their nature, so that they're unable to fulfill it by their own powers. And again, quote, in the state of perfect nature, humanity needs a gratuitous strength added to natural strength for one reason, that is, in order to do and wish supernatural good. But for two reasons, in the state of corrupt nature, viz. In order to be healed, and furthermore, in order to carry out works of supernatural virtue, close quotes. Aquinas' position then is now clearer. In the case of moral action, and I'll return to the word moral in a minute, Adam, before the fall, was adequately equipped to reach natural virtue. That is, he was free to reach it. It was within his capacity. After the fall, however, we are not so free. We also need, even for natural virtue, to be, quote, healed. The term heal is, of course, traditional and Augustinian. But for the sake of clarity, it would have been useful, and perhaps would not have misled Passnow, if Aquinas had also said freed, not free, but freed, liberatus, the Augustinian term, that is, freed from the effects of original sin, which is inter alia what he actually does mean. We can now see part of the problem with interpreting Aquinas' account of freedom in general. It's notorious that some moderns think his account is compatibilist, others libertarian, others a combination. I commented on Passnow's limited references to grace and the absence from his account of the notion of being freed, liberatus. But now we can see that in a sense he is justified in some ways. When Aquinas talks about freedom, he's talking about what human nature is, in effect about the way we were created by God, though we are not now in that condition. And the confusions that arise in our uncertainty over whether we are talking about fallen or unfallen man are compounded by the fact that much of Aquinas' discussion of freedom in Articles 82 and 3 of the Prima Pars is in a very broad context. Not, that is, whether we are free to act morally, but whether we are free to act in general. But perhaps we need more clarity on the possible different analyses required, on the one hand for the proposition, I kick this ball freely, which may introduce metaphysical and Aristotelian problems, and on the other for, I kick this wretched prisoner freely, which may bring up more moral and specifically Augustinian concerns. Augustine's concern with freedom is almost exclusively, though not entirely, in a moral context, embedded in discussion about the nature, effects, and causes of moral evil. Aquinas is, in the Summa, driven in good measure by his concern with free action in an Aristotelian context of means and ends, and of physical determinism, is much more general. In questions 82 and 3 of the Summa Prima Pars on the will and its freedom, there's very little about moral freedom, that is, the freedom which is most obviously affected by original sin. We can see this if we look at 83.1. Aquinas begins with a discussion of decision-making, and an Augustinianism might be expected to follow when he cites St. Paul, Romans 7.15, to the effect that, quote, I do not do the good I will, but rather the evil I hate. But whereas Augustine would have been led by this text into reflection on our fallen spiritual state, Aquinas draws the wider conclusion, quote, man does not have free will, as quotes, then moves on to Aristotle's metaphysics, and then returns to conclude that we cannot take Paul to deny that we walk and run freely, but that our free will needs to be helped by God. So there are at least two potentially conflicting factors to be recognized in Aquinas' account of freedom and its relationship to Augustine's account of grace. On the one hand, Aquinas' discussions are often set in a wider context than Augustine's debate about moral evil and its cure. On the other, they point, as McIntyre saw, to a reformed version of Aristotelian secular ethics. One must admit, however, that part of the difficulty in explicating Aquinas' account is inherited from Augustine himself. Not only in that Aquinas treats Augustine as much too systematic a thinker, but by the misleading way in which, by hindsight, Augustine himself encouraged some of his own writings on freedom, particularly the work on the freedom of the will, to be read. As I said, Augustine's writings on freedom, though innocent of Thomas's wider Aristotelian context, are embedded in discussions of the origins of moral evil. And as with Aquinas, it's often difficult to determine whether when Augustine's talking about freedom, he refers to Adam's unfallen state or to our present condition. This difficulty is complicated further by his important thesis that there is a sense in which we are one in Adam, so that in talking about Adam before the fall, he's also talking about our original, but in some sense also actual, nature. It's true that Augustine tries to extricate himself from ambiguity, in that he emphasizes that we are indeed free, but only to choose the bad. But there's ambiguity here too, in that while unfallen Adam and ourselves are all free in some sense, we have free choice, we are thus free in very different ways. 2 points in summary. First, a little specific attempt in Aquinas to explicate the ambiguity of the concept of freedom, such as that we are now only free to choose the bad, though that is touched on in the De Veritate. But secondly, that in trying to refute any Pelagian claim that the work on free will of Augustine offers an account of the will which in some way itself looks Pelagian, Augustine seems to persuade himself that he intended in that text to give an account of the will other than the account he seems actually to have given. So how do I close this section? Perhaps first by noting that I see unclarities in the analysis of freedom passing from Augustine to Aquinas, and being there exacerbated by Aquinas' Aristotelianism and his easy movement from discussions of moral freedom to questions of freedom to act in a wider sense, but without detailed attention to the relationship between these two topics. Sometimes it at least appears as though one can leave grace and original sin out of straightforward philosophical narratives about freedom while bringing them in as an addendum or correction when the theological going gets tough. This creates difficulties not only in sorting out the relation between moral freedom and freedom to act in general, but trivializes the theory of original sin itself. For that theory is not just a theological dogma. Certainly it is that, but it's also a theological proposal offered in answer to a genuine, experiential, and empirically observed situation that identified by Paul, along with a number of earlier pagans, as not being able to do what one knows to be right. For the dogma of original sin is proposed, at least by Augustine, as a response to what he claims are radical and obvious features of human life and the human condition as we know it. As I've said elsewhere, in the late 19th century, the conditions of human life which support the credibility of the dogma of original sin may have seemed remote from the cozy world of North Atlantic liberals. Their contemporary dogmatic successors, however, have no excuse for following their absurdly rosy account of basic human nature as we experience it. When I was a student, I used to say that the only things the Christians got right were encapsulated in the theory of the fall of man. I conclude this section by agreeing with McIntyre that Aquinas used Augustine to correct Aristotle's theory of the virtues, but add that he also followed Augustine where he was himself, Augustine himself, was ambiguous about which human nature was in question, and would perhaps have done well to be more consistently, even blatantly, Augustinian in his treatment of human incomplete depravity and the perceived need for us to be not just healed, but freed, liberatus. Finally, the third section, souls, bodies, females, and the image of God. We all know that it was a primary concern of the Neoplatonists in antiquity to defend some sort of Platonizing account of the relationship between the soul and the body, primarily against the Stoics, who held that if there is to be any interrelationship between the soul and the body, then the soul must be material, a view attractive to many Christians like Tertullian, who thought that this Stoic position might assist them in an account of bodily resurrection. But Platonists were also under attack from Aristotelians, who held that the soul is the form of a living body possessed of organs. Indeed, Plotinus devoted great efforts to arguing that Aristotle's account of soul-body relations is no more than a glorified, if inglorious, version of the notion of the soul as a harmony of the bodily parts, which Aristotle himself, as well as Plato, had specifically rejected. And it seems that Plotinus had persuaded Augustine of the inadequacy of Aristotelian hilomorphism on these grounds. In this connection, it should be recalled again that only in late antiquity, when Aristotle had become heavily Neoplatonized, was that he was of much interest to Christians. Earlier on, in patristic times, Aristotle was held to be an atheist. That is, in the ancient sense of the word, a denier of providence, like Epicurus, with a dodgy and potentially value-free account of the human soul. Let me drag in an old hobby horse at this point. There are basically two accounts, perhaps complementary rather than antithetical, of human nature in Western philosophy. One, which for simplicity I will label metaphysical and Aristotelian, the other, moral and Platonizing. The primary concern of the metaphysicians is to explain how we are, or are not, a soul-body unity. The primary concern of the moralists is to insist that man is above all a moral agent. Augustine is clearly in this latter Platonizing tradition. But seriously philosophical members of that tradition, while insisting on their own principles, recognized the need to face the challenge of the metaphysicians. Hence Augustine quickly grew dissatisfied with saying, as he does in his early writings, that I am my soul, and or that souls we are simply souls using bodies. He now came to prefer and to think of us as some kind of mixture, a curious stoicizing term, and to say that anyone who thinks he can understand the nature of man without consideration of his body is a complete fool, on the soul and his origin 4:2-3. We are now, he says, a persona, a type of mixture of soul and body which affords a unity which cannot be merely accidental. It seems to have been largely a reflection on theological themes such as the incarnation and the resurrection of the body, the latter very much part of the regular fidei in Christian antiquity, which hastened Augustine's move in that direction. This is not the place, obviously, to explain the incomplete success of Augustine's alternative to hilomorphism, but rather to move quickly and temporarily to Aquinas, who does have an Aristotelian hilomorphism properly understood at his disposal. What I should like to look at, therefore, is the success of such hilomorphism as deployed by Aquinas in resolving the philosophical difficulties of another problem area in Augustine, whose treatment of this matter was well known to his medieval successor. The matter in question is whether woman is created in God's image. First, some background. In the Politics, Aristotle argues against the Platonic view that the virtue of men and women is the same, on the grounds that bodily difference must reflect and be reflected by significant psychological differences, hence that women are inferior to men in their deliberative capacities, a view which the De Generati Animalium reinforces by its biological claims that there is a sense in which women are incomplete men, 737-8. Now, Plato's position of the female soul, so far as we can reconstruct it, and it is a reconstruction, and as it was reconstructed by later Platonizers in antiquity, is that the souls of women are in fact at their best male. Hence, male virtue is available to them under certain conditions. This sort of position reappears among patristic writers very frequently, who more generally divide into two groups. The larger group holding that women are not created in God's image, though they can attain to God's image and likeness by their ways of life. The other group, all Platonizers, Clement, Origen, Gregory of Nyssa, and so on, who hold that the female soul is originally male, or asexual, understood more or less as male. At least for this latter group, sexual difference is a strictly bodily phenomenon, an apparent impossibility, that is, in Aristotelian terms. Roughly speaking, however, Augustine belongs to, or wants to belong to, this group. Now let us turn to the question of the image of God. For ancient Christians, relevant biblical texts required exegesis if that teaching was to be understood. Among the principal texts were the following three: Genesis 1:26 following, dealing with man's creation in God's image, and containing the phrase, male and female he created them, accompanied by Genesis 2:21 following. Secondly, 1 Corinthians 11:7, man is the image and glory of God, and woman is the glory of man. Three, the most difficult of all, even to translate, Ephesians 4:13, and if you look at the translations, you'll see the problems that the translators have with this text, but they don't note. We should arrive at the unity of faith and of knowledge of God unto a perfect male, andra, the word is used in Paul, to the fullness of Christ. Here's quotes. It was especially the Pauline text which caused problems. And Augustine was the first patristic writer to confront 1 Corinthians, which many took to be scriptural evidence against women's creational status as image, head on, explaining it in terms of Genesis as actually supporting the view that woman was so created, but apparently to an inferior degree, since the purpose of her creation itself was procreation. Qua helpmeet, she's not an image of God. Qua human being, she is. Other possibly related explanations of female inadequacy were also available at the time. The idea that in the saeculum the weaker mind should be subservient to the stronger, or more generally that the male sex is more honourable, 83 questions 11, quote, Jesus was male since it was fitting that he should take the human nature of man, the more honourable of the two sexes, close quotes. Now let me turn now to Aquinas, whose extensive use of Aristotelian sociobiology separates him from many of his medieval predecessors. Aquinas agrees with Augustine that it's only, or at least chiefly, in his mind that man is created in God's image, and the distinction of male and female relates only to the body. At this stage, he seems to ignore the Aristotelian point that substantive bodily differences in a hylomorphic account of man should also affect the nature of the soul. Had he followed Aristotle closely here, he might have argued that since the soul of woman and the virtue of woman is different from that of man, it's likely that even though man and woman are both created in God's image, two sorts of images are different. Indeed, he has already offered more scriptural reasons for coming to this very conclusion in Summa Prima Pars 93. Quote, God's image is found equally in both man and woman as regards that point at which the idea of image is principally realized, namely an intelligent nature. But as regards a secondary point, God's image is found in a male in a way which is not found in a female. Close quotes. Of course, he might have gone on to say, and according to a recent interpreter, that's De Seleni, could have gone on to say, that God's image is also found in a woman in a way in which it's not found in a man. But he doesn't do that. Rather, he continues, quote, for man is the beginning and end of woman, just as God is the beginning and end of all creation, quotes, and cites Paul in 1 Corinthians that, quote, the male is the glory and image of God, while the woman is the glory of the man, close quotes. So, like Augustine, Aquinas tries to evade a commonly accepted misogynist, in quotes, reading of 1 Corinthians without abandoning it altogether. That in effect Aquinas more or less spells out the apparent Augustinian view of the inferior version of woman's image of God is hardly surprising, not least when we turn to his selective use of Aristotle, to whom Augustine, as I had noted, has no recourse in such matters. For Aquinas' adoption of hylomorphism, which might have encouraged him to see less inferiority in the female image than Augustine had done, is counterbalanced by the Aristotelian notion that there is a sense in which the male is the perfect type of human being, so that the psychological differences between the sexes, which the hylomorphic theory demands, are interpreted, as in Aristotle himself, and despite a plausible reading of Genesis, that both males and females are created in God's image, as implying the inferiority of one sex, namely the female, to the other. When Aquinas speaks of the actual creation of woman, he begins with the just-mentioned text of the De Generatione Animali of Aristotle, 737 of Book 1, where Aristotle argues that woman is formed as an incomplete male. And this biology predictably issued elsewhere in a clearer account of female psychological inferiority. Woman is by nature subordinate to man because among human beings, in homine, that is, in Aquinas, the power of rational discernment varies considerably. And, quote, woman is subject to man because of the weakness of her nature of both the spirit and the body, as quotes. And she's more prone to concupiscence, according to Secunda Secundae 149. This inadequacy of the incomplete male, as Aquinas spells it out, means not that women are defective in their nature. Nature as a whole needs a woman as such, for the purpose of women is to assist in procreation, broadly understood as including domestic life, following Aristotle, now commenting in Ethics 1182a. Nothing, in fact, could do the job better. The incompleteness comes out when a woman is compared with a man, as the process of conception indicates. For, quote, the active power in the seed of the male tends to produce something like itself, perfect in masculinity, as quotes. And various Aristotelian explanations are given for why at times the active power fails and an inferior female is produced. In brief, then, for Aquinas, woman is created in God's image, but despite the possibility that hylomorphic theory might demand a more radical complementarity, Aristotelian metaphysics and psychology here give way to Aristotelian biology so as to reinforce the tradition, deriving partly from biblical texts urging that women not exercise authority over men, and partly from more general traditional interpretations of scriptural remarks about the image of God, not least that of Augustine, that the degree of imaging, though not of intelligence, is unequal between the sexes. Some limited, final, brief remarks. My choice of three themes has been selective, like Father Owen's Rissole, with which I began. But perhaps, granted the limited nature of my survey, the following variegated points should be taken into account in some future, more wholesale analysis of Aquinas' Augustinianism. 1. Aquinas' teaching on existence shows an unconscious tendency towards and a philosophically enriched clarification of a genuinely Augustinian position. 2. Aquinas' teaching on grace and virtue, on the other hand, shares various Augustinian ambiguities, not least about whether philosophical analysis of human action relates to fallen or unfallen man, while at the same time giving a more Pelagian, not doctrine, but impression to contemporary philosophical readers than Aquinas would probably have produced had he been able to give Augustine the benefit of a more historical or historicist reading. This is apparent not least in his controverted treatment of freedom, where the relation between various old Augustinian difficulties and the antideterminism of Aristotelian accounts of human action in general is left rather unclear. Is this a problem of amalgamating Aristotle, Aquinas the moral theologian, and Aquinas the would-be, I speak here with great hesitation, secular philosopher, as quotes. 3. On woman and the image of God, Aquinas' selective resort to Aristotle reinforces, rather than corrects, some of the more problematic parts of Augustine's position, not least because he is inclined to give disproportionate weight to Aristotle's biological assumptions over against his hylomorphic theses in metaphysics and psychology. However, one should note that there is also another unintegrated but genuine side to Aquinas on this question. In the three themes I have discussed, I have discerned no consistent pattern in the effects of Aquinas' Aristotelianism on his Augustinian base. In one case, the new philosophy develops and elucidates Augustinian intimations. In another, its still undigested state confirms old prejudices, while at the same time widening the philosophical debate. In the third, an opportunity is lost, insofar as Aquinas uses Aristotle selectively only to confirm Augustinian confusion. Rissoles, again, may conform to indeterminate patterns. Father Owens described a rissole as substance without essence. A Polish waitress, also at the University of Toronto, described it as the sweepings off the slaughterhouse floor. I hope neither the ontological nor the pragmatic paradox fits this paper too precisely, but that may serve to highlight just a few of the successes and failures in the complex relationship between Augustine and Aquinas. Thank you.
You have just listened to a lecture organized by the Faculty of Theology in collaboration with the Augustinian Institute entitled Augustine, Aristotelianism and Aquinas. This lecture was delivered by Professor John Rist from the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom.